Hello, beautiful people. Welcome to Fantasy, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I've been saying Candyman's name in the mirror all week and still here alone dreaming of you, Jared Hill.
What is happening?
I'm Travelle Anderson.
I thought I could get a Candyman reference and throw in a little Selena at the end. Why not?
I can't. Not beady beady bomb bomb Jesus.
Yeah. Who are you, bitch? Go on.
I'm just Travelle Anderson, regular Dangler Schmegler. You know how it is. Thank y'all for coming, listening to the show this week. Coming up, we are getting into the weeds of it all. All right. But first, we've got our past the popcorn this week. You've all seen the news on the internet as it relates to the jeopardy of it all. Long story short, the white guy who was the executive producer, Mike Richards, he gave himself the job of being the new host, then stepped down as host, but was still executive producer of Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune. And this week, he has been fired from both of those positions.
Fire.
He's been fired from both of those positions. And listen, inquiring minds wants to know what the hell is going on over there at the Jeopardy, folks.
Well, so what's interesting to me about this story is, like, I know that you look at this and you're like, so the girl hired herself and then had to fire herself. So that is how it comes across to a lot of folks. And to be clear, like, the people at Sony had to be a part of this decision making, right? So, like, Mike Richards did not have all of the power in his little hand with a hole in it. There was a Jesus reference for anybody who caught it. So, but the thing here with Mike Richards is, I've been so upset about it because if Mike Richards' behavior, his history, his demeanor, whatever it is, was so bad that he could not be the face of the show, he should not have been able to be the leader of the show either, right? And I was tweeting about this because it frustrated me that this is why, like, diversity and inclusion and equity initiatives aren't necessarily effective because, like, we will go out of our way to protect this white man who we have seen is a problem, right? Like, whether we're talking about race, whether we're talking about women, like, all of the different things that have come against him. But, like, it's okay. He can't be the face, but he can still be the leader. Like, well, how does that even work?
For anybody who has not actually read the statement by the Sony representative, I forget if she's president or VP, but she basically said in the email that she sent to the staff that they thought by having him step down as host and still stay on as executive producer, that it would allow them to, like, you know, continue with business as usual. And it was only after they realized that it would not, that they began exploring this particular option that we're here with now.
That's the most infuriating part of the entire statement, right? So the statement says, we had hoped that when Mike stepped down from the host position at Jeopardy, it would have minimized the disruption and internal difficulties we have all experienced these last few weeks. That clearly has not happened. And it's like, what?
You don't want to know?
How does that even work?
You want to know? I would like to submit a nomination for the new host, the new permanent host of Jeopardy.
Is it me?
Actually, it was going to be you. You watch
really?
It. You, I know you're a big fan. You're also super smart. Okay, I know I don't give you compliments often, but you are super smart. You have a wealth of knowledge. And I think that you would be great. You have experience, you know, on camera. You consider yourself to be a comedian, although I disagree. And so all of that, I think, would help.
Wait. see, comedian Jared from like 10 years ago is like, now why am I in it? First of all, very flattering. Thank you. I've always said that, like, after Alex Trebek, whenever Alex Trebek was going to be done with that job, I really wanted it. And then, like, I went and watched a couple of live tapings, and I was like, oh my God, God, if you're listening, I want this job. And then it didn't exactly
happen
that way.
That's
it's
all
fine.
Right. That's okay.
It's fine. It could still happen because they apparently don't know who the host is going to be.
Right.
So there's that.
Period. Okay.
We should start a campaign on the Twitter, Jarrett for Jeopardy or something like that.
Yes.
I also want the Saturday Night Live Weekend Update job because I think that might be coming up because Colin Jost.
You just
whatever.
Want a job.
You guys,
you just want a
fine.
Job. That's what
I
this
want,
is.
I'll take both jobs low-key if we really want to talk about it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, it's time to get high. We're talking about weed. Don't go anywhere.
Not get high. Fantai This Week is brought to you by the wonderful folks over at Brooklinen. All right, I have told y'all about these sheets, okay? After you have had a very long day dealing with Jared's foolishness, sometimes you just need to luxuriate.
Now
what? You just need to luxuriate, okay? You need to put away all of the pressures of the world. You know, you just need to take them off your shoulders. And I promise you, these Brooklinen sheets.
If you don't shut up and move on.
These Brooklinen sheets, I promise you, though, that's what they do for me. Okay. Seasons are a changing, and so will your personal taste. I'm sure you're probably tired of that late stage summer moment. You know, the humidity is like killing you in the middle of your sleep. Why don't you freshen up your fall with a change in decor, all while upgrading your comfort? That's where Brooklinen comes in. It's time to save big and invest in your comfort. Doing Brooklinen's Labor Day sale happening right now, okay? Brooklinen makes bedding for every kind of sleeper, whether you sleep hot, cold, or somewhere in between. They have got you covered, Goldilocks, okay? And it doesn't stop there. Bedroom is all set. You got your sheets. You cool with that? All right, well, then make every day a spa day with a choice selection from their excellent and absorbent towel collection, all right? Available in a number of colors, okay, honey? Now, I done told y'all, okay? Y'all think we be lying when we doing these ads, okay? Just go on and get you one of them Brooklinen duvet situations, okay? It'll hold you like Jesus Christ, I promise, all right? Freshen up your fall with Brooklinen, the one-stop shop for comfort. Shop the Labor Day savings event now for savings on all things comfort. And if you can't decide right now, that's all right. You can always invest in your comfort with the promo code FANTAI anytime, all right? That's brooklinen.com, promo code FANTAI.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Listen, there's a lot happening around the world right now that is contributing to my own mental health and the ways that I've been feeling depressed and down and having a really difficult time. But you may not be feeling down and out and depressed or like you're at a total loss. But if your stress is high, you could probably still use the chance to unload. Unload and get it out. Talk to someone who's completely unbiased about your life. Someone who isn't going to judge you or take sides on anything. You'll be surprised at how much that can help. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. And it can be more affordable than in-person therapy. So see if it's for you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Fantai listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/Fantai. Have your first session in under 48 hours, which is miraculous, at BetterHelp, BETTERHELP.com/Fantai.
Purr. Alrighty, beautiful people. As y'all know, Jared and I live in Los Angeles, and we like to smoke the reefers, okay? And shout out to those Lumi micro dose drops as well. But as we know, marijuana is still criminalized all over the place. Black and brown folks are still incarcerated for things that a whole lot of white folks are making big bank off of these days. And if you work at one of those jobs that still be drug testing you, a little Mary Jane could have you in the unemployment line.
First of all, I want to do a quick fact check that Jared does not smoke the reefer. Jared enjoys eating the reefer. So I want to put that out there. But one of the challenges of weed is that there's so much conflicting messaging about it. There's very little study about it. And there are so many wonderful things about she that we just love.
Oh, yes.
We wanted to have a conversation about the wheat and give it proper Fantai treatment. We invited a man that's had a very Fantai kind of relationship with the reefer, having been arrested for it back in the day, but now making real money in his family business, Ball Family Farms, a Los Angeles-based social equity licensed premium cannabis company. Chris Ball, welcome to Fantai.
How y'all doing?
Doing well, doing well. I may or may not have had an edible in the spirit of the episode. But first things first, I would love for you to kind of tell us about your background or experience with weed, because you have such an interesting story.
Yeah, sure. I got my first experience with weed probably when I was about 10. And it was, you know, the funny smelling cigarette my dad used to smoke after dinner. So that was my first introduction to it. You know, I knew what regular cigarettes were because my mom smoked those. And then my dad's little cigarettes just smelled a little bit different. I would then see that same funny smelling cigarette at family barbecues, picnics, Christmas time, Thanksgiving. Uncles were smoking it, grandma smoking it, aunts, everyone, cousins. So it just kind of became a part of my culture. So I grew up in the 80s. So I grew up during a time when the Reagan era was alive and well, and there was a Just Say No to Drugs campaign. So as you can imagine, as a young guy, it was pretty confusing, you know, to go to school and hear all this Just Say No, but then get home or get around my family and see the people who I cared and loved about, cared about and loved the most partaking in it. So I figured it out, though, as time went on and as I grew up, I started to understand the difference and figured it out. So ethically and morally, I felt there was never anything wrong with the reefer or the weed.
The weed, okay.
You know, to the weed. Once I got to high school, my cousin Earl was the neighborhood weed man, and cousin Earl was always super fresh. Jordans, white t-shirts, jewelry, had a car at 16. He was the guy. I wanted to be the guy, but, you know, I wasn't really partaking in any of that kind of stuff. I was more focused on girls and football and sports and, you know, the regular things that, you know, a 16-year-old kid is excited about. So I did ask my cousin Earl one day, though, to hook me up with an ounce and let me try my hand at selling weed. And needless to say, I was pretty terrible at it. I think I probably only sold about half of the ounce, and then I think I gave the rest of it away. So at that point, I just kind of felt like it wasn't for me, so I put it down. Once I graduated high school, my parents had that talk with me and said, look, Chris, you know, we can't afford to send you to college. So you're either going to have to get a job or you're going to have to, you know, get up out of here or do something. If you're going to figure out another way to go to school, you need to do that, but we can't help you. So at that point, I wasn't ready to go into the real world. I still had dreams and aspirations of being a pro football player and wanting to be the first kid in my family to go to college. So I packed up my stuff, moved out, moved in with a buddy of mine and called cousin Earl back. Now, this time I'm 18, 19, and I knew that my stakes were higher. I knew if I was going to get another ounce from cousin Earl, I was going to have to make it work. So that's what I did. I got my ounce. I went and enrolled in Mount Sac Junior College in Walnut, California, and I sold weed for 2 years out of my backpack to put myself through school, paid for my tuition, paid for my books, put gas in my little Volkswagen Bug, and put food in my stomach. That's how
Shout
I survived.
Shout out to the Volkswagen Bug that got a lot of people through.
The 1969 yes. canary yellow Volkswagen Bug with one blue
nice.
Fender.
Nice.
One blue fender. All right. So after 2 years of that, I wound up receiving a full athletic scholarship to play football at the University of California, Berkeley. And that's when my weed entrepreneurship stopped. I put the weed down, got my scholarship to school and figured and thought that I was going to be get drafted in the first round after 2 years and make millions of dollars and live life happily ever after. Well, that did not happen. OK, I did graduate, but I wind up getting in some trouble my senior year, had a big mouth mouthing off to the press and my coach wound up benching me. So I wind up signing as a free agent to the San Francisco 49ers and didn't get $1 million. Kind of bounced around a little bit, bounced around the NFL a little bit till I found myself over in the CFL in British Columbia, playing for the BC Lions in Vancouver, Canada. Now, this is where I first learned about growing weed. Okay, before I was just a middleman. I just trapped weed. I bought weed or got weed. I put my tax on it and I made my money. When I got to Canada, this was the first time I had ever seen weed from seed to harvest. And once I saw that process, I was blown away. Right. I just kind of fell in love with cultivation. I fell in love with the plant. I fell in love with cannabis even more. And so I kind of kept that in my head. Now, during this time, it's pretty interesting because in the off season, us football players, how some of us would supplement our income is that we would traffic weed from Canada back to the United States, all the way back down to L.A. I won't get into too much how I was doing that because I'm not sure. If guys up there are still doing this, so I don't want to give nothing away now that I have this platform. But this is how we supplemented our income. Now, weed in Canada was about a third of the price that it was in Los Angeles. So as you can imagine, I made a lot of money very, very fast. And I became very popular in Los Angeles very, very fast because I was able to undercut the market based off of how cheap I was getting it from in Canada. This went on for a few years, about 3 or 4 years. I eventually made a really big name for myself in LA. I became known as the football player who had the packs for
the low.
Right? And for the low.
Hey, man.
For the low. Okay. I wasn't trying to break the bank. I was just trying to blow through as much as I could and make as much money as I could. Until I eventually attracted the attention of the federal government in 2010 and caught my indictment. So I caught my indictment. I was charged with the conspiracy to distribute 2,000 pounds of marijuana across the United States.
2,000 pounds?
Just to give you a little bit of...
Sweet God.
Yeah. And that wasn't all of it. That was just what they caught, what they found, right? So I was looking at a 10-year mandatory minimum on my case, right? It was the first time I had ever been arrested, never been in any trouble a day in my life. This was my first interaction with the law besides a speeding ticket. So as you can imagine, when I heard 10-year mandatory minimum, I lost my shit. I said, you got to be kidding me. I'm going to prison for 10 years for selling some weed. This has to be a joke. What I found out later was that I was attached to a very prominent drug cartel in the United States. And I had no idea that I was even working with these people. You know, when I finally got to prison, when I finally got to court, it was a 14-man indictment. And I looked around and saw, you know, 10 other guys that I had never seen in my entire life. So at that point, I knew, you know, I had to get myself out of it. So my attorney advised me, said, look, you know, they kind of know that you're not involved in this whole thing. I was the only black face in the indictment. All the rest of the guys were Hispanic. There was 14,000 pages of phone taps. You know what I'm saying? Out of those 14,000 pages, I was on 11, right? So it was pretty obvious that I didn't really have anything to do with the organized crime that was happening, that I just kind of came in as the weed guy. So what I did was I pled out. You know, I pled out and took responsibility for about 400 pounds of the 2,000, and they reduced my sentence to about 30 months. I signed my deal for 30 months, got out on a pretrial release, which means the judge allowed me to bail out until it was time for me to report back for sentencing. My my lawyer worked out a deal with the judge that said, you know, Chris shouldn't have to come back to report for sentencing until the case is over, right? The judge said, okay, no problem. Let's make sure everybody else is done. And then Chris already signed his deal. Then he can come back and start his time. Well, the number one and two on the case fought the case for about 5 years, right? As you can imagine, during that 5 years, I kept a job. Went and got a job at Abercrombie & Fitch, folding T-shirts as a 32-year-old college graduate. Pretty embarrassing. Until I eventually got a job with Nike out in Las Vegas. Nike brought me in to run the NFL department for them back in 2012 out of Las Vegas. So I did that. I was working for Nike until it was time for me to report back. 5 years later, I go back. Judge gives me time served. I walk out of there free man. During that 5 years, I figured out that corporate America just wasn't for me. I was an ex-football player. I was an ex-street guy. Corporate America just wasn't my thing. You would think that, you know, working at Nike, one of the most prestigious companies in the world, I was making really good money. I was wearing shorts and tennis shoes to work every single day talking about football. You would think that that would make a guy like me happy, but it didn't. So what did I do? As soon as I got off probation, as soon as the judge gave me time served, about a month later, I quit my job at Nike, drove back to LA with all my savings and bought myself a 14 light grow in Van Nuys, California. At this point, my family and friends were extremely upset and confused at my decisions. Okay. They did not understand why I would leave a job after being there for 3 years, why I was in a great position, why I hadn't gotten a speck of trouble, why I would just leave all of that and go right back to the weed industry. In my brain, I knew something that they didn't, right? I knew that I wasn't happy, and I knew that if I could just get back down to LA and figure out the growing part of it, that I could get myself involved in maybe some Prop D compliant shops that some of my friends owned and become a caregiver for the patients, right? That's really what I wanted to do. I came back down, bought that grow, and I literally burnt up plants for a good year before I even made it through my first harvest successfully. But like I said, I had some savings, you know, for my job over at Nike, and then once it finally clicked, I started moving my weed over to the dispensaries, to the pre-ICOs that my boys were owning, right? And these were all guys that I would sell weed to back in the day when I was getting weed from Canada. So we had a love for each other, right? There was some street loyalty there that got me in those doors. Got really good at it, you know, over the next year, next 2 years. And then I was introduced to the social equity program in 2018. And that's when Ball Family Farms was officially born.
And I know that y'all are a very successful farm. Talk about the success of the farm right now. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, we're doing extremely well. This past year, I think we did about $12 million in overall gross sales. The company, we are expanding. We are expanding downstairs. We have a 40,000 square foot facility. The past 2 years, we've only been operating in about 20,000 square feet of that. January 1st of this year, we were finally able to acquire the downstairs of our facility and acquire another 20,000 square feet. So we're about to put another 150 lights down there, plus our solventless manufacturing lab, plus our kitchen, and plus our distribution center. So we will be doing that. And then we bought 75 acres out in Oklahoma. So we are now officially a multi-state operator. We poured concrete on that facility just last week. So we're going to be expanding out in Oklahoma over the next 6 months as well.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Okay, so Travell, in a less detailed story, though, but like, tell us, what has been your history with weed?
Oh, I don't have a family farm where I'm growing stuff. That's not my journey, unfortunately. Although hearing those profits, I'm like, maybe I need to get into a little something, something. But to Chris's story, talking about like, you know, the little not cigarettes, right? That like family and friends were smoking back in the day. For me, it's a very similar story. But for me, it was my older brother and my cousins, right? They would always leave the family reunion and come back with low set eyes, smelling kind of different. And everybody's like, what the hell is going on? But I was like, I'm interested, but you know, I was the goody two shoes of the family, so I didn't have my first puff until college, and then didn't even really attach to it until I moved to LA. And you know, there's dispensaries all over the fucking place in this city, and you know, one day I was like, you know what, she needs to do a little relaxation. She needs a little something. Let me go and take myself over to MedMen or, you know, one of the little dispensaries. And ever since, it's been a really great relationship between me and the marijuanas. I love it. I have a whole bag sitting in my living room. Because, you know, you got different strains. You got the indica and the sativa, the hybrid. You got the little CBD situation. You could do your edibles. They got drinks now, okay? This is the old side of me coming out. They've got drinks. You can drink your cannabis if you want to.
And it hits a lot faster.
Period.
So that's really dope. Oh, I said dope. That's funny. I had a very different relationship than you two heathens. I was way more conservative as a kid. And like my mom was like super strict with us. So I would see like my cousin smoking. I would see like a few people in the family smoking, but like I wasn't even around it a whole lot. But then I actually did not even really try weed until I had moved to LA, and I was like 25, 26. And like I was trying edibles, I was trying vaping, but like nothing was working to get me high. And so then I was like, well, you know, maybe it just doesn't work for me. And then my friend came to town and he bought some cookies from one of the places here. And like for whatever reason, the cookie... That started working.
That did it.
But the first time I ever actually got high was some gummies that had me going bananas. And like, I think there must have been something else in there, because I was like watching words come out of people's mouths and looking at music play. Wow. It was bananas.
Oh, yeah. But, you were on a trip, honey. You were on a trip. You took something else.
But that was the first time you smoked, though?
That was the first time I ever actually got high.
That happened to me, though, too. The first time I ever tried to get high in high school, I got really paranoid. My chest started to blow up. I couldn't taste nothing. And I went to the nurse's office and had him call my mom to tell her to come pick me up because I thought I was dying. Oh, my God.
Yikes. Yeah, so, no, yeah. I was out in Venice here in LA, walking up and down the sidewalk trying to get fresh air and being paranoid that I must look like a junkie. And I had a cup in my hand because I was drinking water. And I was like, oh, my God, someone's going to put money in my cup. Like,
I can't.
I just thought I had ruined my life.
I can't.
But now, a few years later, like I'm able to use it for creative on days when I'm writing or need to design or, you know, do projects. It's actually really helpful for me with focus in a way that even like antidepressants and other stuff hasn't been effective. And so it took me a long time, but I didn't realize that I had a lot of judgment around it. Because when I first started getting high, I would spend the whole time trying to not look high, right? Mm-hmm. And like I was like, oh, I feel something about this that I didn't know I did. Okay, so Chris, on this show, we like to talk about the things we love about something and the things we hate about something. Our fan things, like, are the things that we love. Talk to me about like a couple of the things that you love about weed.
The first thing I love about weed is what it does and how it helps people. I was able to take my mom has rheumatoid arthritis, and I was able to take her off of her opioid painkillers and stuff through edibles. Also, you know, used to watch my dad smoke, and my dad had a very serious problem. So the weed would definitely, you know, calm him down and make him normal. So the fact that the health benefits that marijuana has, that the whole world will soon find out as we get closer to federal legalization. And then there's those tax dollars that get to go into R&D to figure out just how wonderful that this plant is. I believe that weed would definitely become the new age Western medicine. You know, I believe it will be used for a lot of things to cure and to heal and to help people with ailments. And so that's the first thing that I love about it. The second thing that I love about it is the fact that growing up and watching my uncles and people like that sell drugs and sell weed all that time. And for me to actually be doing it and me to actually have to go to prison for it. And now to be in a space where I can kind of call myself a legal drug dealer. I still get a kick out of that. I still get a kick out of, you know, call it what you will, but I still get a kick out of being the neighborhood weed man, so to speak. It's always been something that I've had a passion for. I've always loved the game, the traditional market game, the sport and the competition of growing and selling weed and how much I could sell and how, you know, if I could grow the best weed and compare it to this grower, things like that. It's just in my heart that gets me up every morning.
So for your information, Chris, I'm like an entertainment reporter. And so I do a lot of stuff like media representation and stuff like that. And as you were talking about the health benefits of weed, I was thinking back to, like, I feel like all of the majority of the media representations of weed that I remember when I was coming up, it was like in one of two camps. It was either people talking about how they needed it for their glaucoma because it helped alleviate issues, or it was the lazy.
To be clear, glaucoma was always in air quotes, though. It was always like, I got glaucoma. Right. Yeah.
Right. And then on the other end, it was the weed head imagery, right? It was right. What's the name of that movie with Dave Chappelle? Half Baked.
Mm-hmm.
It was the half baked imagery, yeah, where like you smoke and you're
stupid.
Lazy.
Yeah, you lazy. You don't.
And it
do
made
nothing.
You stupid.
Right. Right.
Right. Because I feel like it's that lazy, stupid side of things that I feel like a lot of people most readily associate with weed. We don't talk enough about even what you were saying, Jared, the ways it can help you on your creative journeys or the ways it can help you on your health journeys. My mother is one of those people who to this day is very much like, she don't do no kind of drugs except the ones that are prescribed to her by the doctor. Okay, honey. And so myself, who, you know, is open about smoking weed or whatnot, and my little sister, she's 20 or something like that, 1920. We both partakes in the cannabis, okay? And my mother still has issues wrapped up in it. And so that's what I was thinking. That's why I was making all those faces while you were talking.
We're still a long way away from the complete, you know, destigmatization of cannabis, but I see it happening. Our government like loves to use the TV, you know, to brainwash us, in my opinion. So the more I watch and the more shows that I see, you start to see these, you know, lily white ladies stressed out about their kids, and then they go out on the porch and then they sparking up a joint. Okay, so when we keep seeing that, that means that they're about to do something. They're about to try to destigmatize the minds and try to play with people's minds and say, okay, cannabis is now good. Mm. They just ain't all the way there yet. Say they still got to get their federal things together so they can figure out how to take all of our money away from doing it. And then once they do that, then you'll see that federal legalization pass and you'll see everybody and their mama smoking weed.
I'm fascinated by this because I feel like growing up in like a super duper Christian house and like all of that, I have all these stigmas still attached to it that I'm like working through and trying to figure out how I feel about. But like my mom was just like, my parents did not do drugs and they barely drank. They drank like occasionally. If they fired up the blender and made a daiquiri or something, it was a big thing.
Yes,
but like my parents have just never really been into much of anything. And so then for me, like as an adult, I find like I really appreciate the way that I can write when I'm, you know, taking an edible and wherever I am, in cruising altitude, as I often call it. Or like I appreciate the way that I can focus. I appreciate the ways that it makes things a whole lot funnier to me sometimes. But I'm also having to appreciate that the two of you have been talking about strains and things like that. And like, I don't do like a lot of strain exploration. I'm good for a hybrid piece of chocolate or something and keep it pushing. But now I'm thinking more about like, I need to be more thorough in the way that I even like am looking at strains and things like that. Chris, can you talk a little bit about how strains work?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously there's the indica, right? The indica strain, and that strain is typically used for pain or to put you to sleep. Mm-hmm. You have your sativa.
Travell, you seem aware.
Okay. You then have your sativa, and that's normally your happy weed, right? That's your daytime smoke. That's the weed that's supposed to give you some energy. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you know, you have your typical hybrid weed, which is, you know, a little bit of indica, a little bit of a sativa. It's not going to make you sleepy. It's not going to make you too couch lock. And it's definitely not going to make you want to run around outside and clean up the house like a sativa would. It's supposed to just be that neutral, you know, that neutral smoke and neutral feeling. And then as you get more in depth, you know, you have indica dominant hybrid, sativa dominant, hybrid. So those are the five, you know, strain types or categories that there are. And then after that, we start getting into stuff like terpenes. And that means what the weed tastes like, right? You got all these gelatos and creams and foods and all these different type of things. So that's pretty much the breakdown on that.
So, okay, I think we've got a good understanding of like what we like about weed. But what are the antis? Travell, what is something that like is annoying to you about weed?
Well, I think for me, and I think it's good to have you here, Chris, for this part of the conversation specifically, is like we talk a lot about, and I mentioned it in my intro, about the ways in which, you know, Black and brown folks in particular have been criminalized, right, and locked up. My brother is in jail right now. I mean, he did more than just the drug stuff, okay, but you know, but that was part of the contributing stuff, you know. But like we talk about the criminalization of it a lot, and then at the same time we see the same ways in which, like I said, a lot of white folks, a lot of venture capitalists, a lot of, you know, people are making bank off of this. And I just think about the ways in which just a few weeks ago with Sha'Carri Richardson, right, who got, you know, booted from the Olympics for smoking, but at the same time there was all of these promotions about cannabis companies at the Olympics. And so it was just like choose a side, you know, like choose one of them. And it just feels like the Black and brown folks are continually being, you know, the ones who are negatively impacted, even as we see kind of this slow road to full legalization and decriminalization. So, like, I think that's the main thing that pops in my head when I'm thinking of, like, the issues with, like, the industry associated with cannabis right now.
Yeah, I agree with you, Travell. That is, you know, one of the most irritating things, you know, about this industry. But also, you know, when you look at it from an operating standpoint, right, of the industry, I mean, for the past 2.5 years, like I couldn't even get a bank account, you know, because of this stigmatization, right? Because of this, oh, it's a schedule, it's a drug, it's this, it's that. Well, I would love for the states and the government, the federal government, to finally get on the same page, because those type of things, you know, put me and my family at risk, right? Everyone knows that cannabis companies, we can only deal in cash because we can't get a bank. You know, thank God, you know, we finally found a bank that would bank with us, but they're going to charge us 17% on our money per month, you know, to bank our money, you know? So it's like things like that, you know, if the states and the federal government could just finally get on the same page and agree on something, this thing, you know, this industry could then thrive, right? Even with the social equity program over here in LA, that program needs work. You know, I'm one of the only social equity applicants that are actually having some success, you know, in this business. And that's because there are no resources, you know, the government, our state, there's no money set aside, you know, for these social equity applicants to get them through their business transactions or to even teach them how to run a business, right? If you social equity, what does that mean? You're low income, you know, you grew up in a zip code, you know, that's been mostly impacted by the war on drugs. That's how you qualify to get the license. Well, how the hell are these people supposed to know how to run a business? They ain't got no money. You know what I mean? So, you know, I make the analogy all the time. If Berkeley would have just gave me a scholarship, admitted me to school, but didn't give me no resources to be successful, didn't give me a tutor, didn't give me a scholarship check, didn't make sure my books and tuition and stuff was paid for, I would have flunked out of school. There's no way I could have made it. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, with all these things going on, these are some of the things that are most irritating about the cannabis space for me. Our Instagram page of 30,000 followers just got taken down last night.
Wow.
You know, so now I'm fighting with IG trying to get my Instagram page back because, you know, it's a drug. No, it's not. Wow. Come on, y'all. We need to get this shit together. You know,
I'm curious about the program that you're a part of in Los Angeles. And I know that other states have things similar to them. What is the program called and how does that work?
The social equity program?
Yeah.
Yeah. So It's called the Social Equity Program. It originated out in Oakland. A group called the California Minority Alliance were the guys who kind of pioneered it out there and then brought it down here to Los Angeles. And basically what it is it's a program dedicated to give licenses to people who have been, you know, negatively impacted by the war on drugs, so to speak. And it was three tiers, right? It was tier one, if you actually had an arrest or a conviction or some sort of felony, drug felony. Tier two was that if somebody in your family, a mother, a father, an uncle, or somebody in your household was arrested for it. And then tier three was that if you lived in a certain zip code, right? They kind of mapped out which areas in Los Angeles were the most impacted by the war on drugs and then said, okay, if you lived in that zip code or grew up there for a certain amount of time, you would be tier three. And the tiers just mean how much equity you need to have in the license, right? So tier one applicants like myself, we must own 51%, you know, of the license. That way we're always in control of the license. Tier two was like 33%. And then tier three, there wasn't any percentage you had to own, that you just had to be on the license, mm-hmm. or something like that. I'm not really too sure about tier three. So that's really what it was for. And I think in the beginning, LA only gave out 100 licenses, you know. So besides the people who had the dispensaries, the pre-ICOs, you know, they were first. Those people who've had those pre-ICOs since like 1996 or whatever, they got their retail licenses. And then the next license that they offered up was the cultivation license. So I think out of, you know, it had to be something like 9,000 or 10,000 applicants, they gave out, you know, 100, and I was number 7 out of the 100. Wow. And I qualified as a tier one applicant, a tier one social equity applicant. That's how I got my license. So that's what the program is supposed to be about, right? Helping. They didn't want to just give all the licenses to the rich white folks. Mm-hmm. The CMA, you know, the California Minority Alliance, three brothers came in and said, look, you need to dedicate some of these licenses to the people who've actually suffered for this. It's not fair that you just give it to these white people, right? So then they said, okay, we'll do the first 100 licenses to those people. And now, you know, from what I understand, Los Angeles is not even giving out any more licenses that if you're not social equity until like 2025 or 24 or something like that. Like the only people that can actually get a license now are social equity applicants. There's no more general applications.
Well, shit, Travell, what are you doing after the show? Well, actually, to that point, though, I am curious, like, I know people like try to grow at home and things like that. And what tips would you have for someone that was thinking about wanting to get into this?
My advice with that would definitely be to try at home. Don't try to go out and get yourself a facility because you're gonna waste a bunch of money, right? The first thing I would do is try to get you a little gorilla tent. You know, they sell them things by like the 5x5s or the 10x10. Put you one or two lights in there, get you a 3 or 4 plants, maybe 5 plants, and then try to grow yourself. Figure it out at home first before you try to go into commercially growing. Because like I said, when I bought my first grow, I bought a 5,000 square foot facility. I have 14 lights in there and I just burnt stuff up and lost a lot of money trying to learn how to do this. So that would be my first, you know, I would definitely encourage people to do that. Or, you know, maybe go intern. You know, we are always taking interns over at BFF for people who just want to come in and donate their time and learn how to grow. So pick a company that you like, somebody that you believe in their product, that you smoke their flower and you like it, and maybe contact them and say, hey, you mind if I come in and offer some extra hands and some help and intern on the cultivation side and learn what you're doing before you actually, you know, try to go get you a license and get deep into it.
I love that. Before we go, I did want to ask, a few months ago, we mentioned on the show that we were probably going to do an episode on weed, and somebody emailed us talking about, like, you know, one of the issues that they had with quote unquote weed culture, which was that they feel as if it's difficult to talk about the fact that, like, a lot of the research in terms of, like, long-term impacts of weed is, you know, still up in the air in some respects, and that they were talking about, like, a lot of folks that they know who, you know, did a little puff-puff pass, did not necessarily have, you know, the positive reactions that we've been talking about on the show. So I wanted to hear a little bit from you, particularly about, like, things that people should consider about, like, whether or not they should be smoking or inhaling or, you know, eating the edibles or whatever, you know, based on their own situation that they got going on, since it, I guess, it could have adverse or not necessarily positive effects for some people.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, by the way. And how I typically like to break that question down is just like this. Weed is very similar to wine, right? There are a lot of different wines out there, right? There's Cabs, there's Merlots, there's Sauvignon Blancs, there's this, there's that, right? Me, myself, I'm a Sauvignon Blanc and a Chardonnay man. I don't like Cabernets, right? I don't like the way they make me feel. I don't like the way they taste. So it's the same thing with marijuana, right? There are a million different strains of weed out there, right? All weed has a cannabinoid profile. Humans have a cannabinoid profile, right? Weed is cannabis. There are cannabinoids there. So what people have to do is they have to try different things. You got to find the weed strain that levels up with your cannabinoid profile, right? Now you see some people who they smoke religiously, constantly. They cannot stop. They have found their match. They have found the weed that meshes with their cannabinoid profile. The people who are having these adverse reactions to it, you have not found yours yet. That's why it's doing that. That's why, or you're taking too much. You may be eating too much. You may be smoking too much, you know? So when people finally figure out marijuana and how it works, and you may buy a strain or you may buy a brand and you say, whoop, that one didn't work for me. Let me try something else. You got to keep trying it. I had tried four different wines before I found Sauvignon Blanc and said, oh, I like the way this one tastes and I love the way it makes me feel. So I'm going to stay here. Right. So it's just more and more research and development that needs to happen. Like I said, because of all the stigma, we don't get to get out all of this information to the public and the people because there's still so much. Is it bad? Is it good? Is it the devil drug? Is America going to become lazy and potheads and not want to do nothing? Well, why don't you just look at the Canadians? It's been legal over there for the past 10, 20 years. Them people seem just fine to me.
Well, there you go.
Period.
Crystal, right. And that's that on that.
And that's that on that.
Chris, tell people where they can find out more about Ball Family Farms and what you've built.
We are definitely trying to get our Instagram page back. So that that page is at Ball Family Farms. Okay. We do have a backup page as well. So that's at Ball Family Farms _backup. So a bunch of our followers have gone there for now just till we get our page back up and running. Or you could always visit us on our website at www.ballfamilyfarms.com. And, you know, the rest is history. You can shop there. You can find out where all of our weed strains are. There's bios about me, my team, everything.
And the piece that I wrote featuring Chris, we'll make sure to put the link to that in the episode notes as well. Chris Ball from Ball Family Farms, really, really grateful that you spent some time with us today. I know we're going to get a lot of feedback. We might have to call you for some backup.
Anytime, Jared. Anytime. Thank you for having me. Love talking to you. And thank you for always looking out and letting me tell my story, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Chris. Tweet at us or post using the hashtag FansHighFam. We'll be jumping in, responding to your posts from Twitter and Instagram at FansHigh Podcast. When we come back, why y'all hate us so much, and listener feedback and our dishonorable mentions. Don't go anywhere.
If you're sick of constantly arguing with the people closest to you about topics that really aren't going to change the world, we're here to take that stress off of your shoulders. We take care of it for you on We Got This with Mark and Hal.
That's right, Hal. If you have a subjective question that you want answered objectively once and for all time for all of the people of the world, questions like who's the best Disney villain, Mac or PC, or should you put ketchup on a hot dog? That's why we're here.
Yes, I get that these are the biggest questions of our time, and we're often joined by special guests like Nathan Fillion, Orlando Jones, and Paget Brewster. So let Mark and Hal take care of it for you on We Got This with Mark and Hal, weekly on Maximum Fun.
I'm going first. It's me, Jackie Cation.
Man, she's always this bossy. Hi. I'm Lori Kilmartin. We're a bunch of stand-up comics, and we've been doing comedy like 60 years total, both of us, but we look amazing.
We're working out. We drop every Monday on Max Fun, and it's called The Jackie Lori Show, and you could listen to it and learn about comedy and learn about anger management and all the things.
And Jackie is married but childless, and I'm unmarried but child full. So together, we make one complete woman.
Is that just what that one's going to end?
Yeah. And we try to make Kyle laugh just like that and say, oh my God, every episode.
It's a good job.
Jackie and Lori Show, Mondays, only on Maximum Fun.
We
Welcome back, beautiful people. We're now going to get into our listener feedback segment. Your opportunity to tell us how much you love us, because we know you do. First up, we've got a tweet here that you pulled, Jared.
Oh, I haven't seen this. What does it say?
So we have a tweet here from Shannon Shannon that says, quote,
oh,
I live for Jared Hill's voice change when they do the Dipsy ads on Fanti.
Oh, that's so sweet, because I get so much shit about it from the people around here.
Anyway,
shout out to Shannon. Shannon, you're my favorite. Don't tell Monique. Moving on.
I can't. All right. So we've got an email here from Don, the legendary, iconic Don Rhodes. I don't know if y'all are familiar with Don Rhodes and her work. She's a great Black woman journalist. But she did an email in response to our last episode, I Do Not Dream of Labor. She says, hi, my loves. As a Black woman journalist, rest is really important for me. There was an Instagram slide recently. I think it was from Therapy for Black Girls that said something to the effect of, you don't need permission to rest. You don't need to earn your rest. I think this idea that rest is earned started with my mom. She was a single mother, always hustling. When I was a teenager, I was doing honors classes plus a sport and usually church on Sunday. Me too, sis. She says, a bitch be tired, all right? I remember my mom, I remember my mom getting on my case if I tried to nap some weekends. I think she saw it as me not managing my homework schedule, or worse, avoiding work and being lazy, when what I needed was a break. Even now, when I take naps in the middle of the day, I go through this mental process of reminding myself, I'm grown, I'm listening to my body, I don't need to feel guilty, so I'm taking this here nap. Journalism reinforces this aversion to rest. While I know this isn't unique to us, I know you two will relate to being in a situation where there's an unspoken mandate to work when you're not supposed to, going quote unquote above and beyond your call of duty to work nights and weekends to meet a deadline or work on a longer term piece. You're supposed to be constantly on call and prepared to answer emails on nights and weekends. People don't always tell you to do that, but they don't stop you either. And it's a work ethic manager's praise. You think you exist in a meritocracy, so if you out-hustle your peers, you'll advance. But after a while, you realize the grift. All those extra hours ain't earned me a raise. I haven't been promoted into the roles I wanted off the back of those all-nighters I pulled. You realize you're being squeezed for all the labor you can muster. This is what leads to burnout. One more paragraph. I want to read the whole thing because it's amazing. I realized I had to set boundaries and safeguard my quote-unquote off time because I knew my managers wouldn't. Now, as a manager, I am militant about stop times for work. We try to encourage our teams to take breaks during the day, schedule regular vacations, fully disengage on weekends, make space for their mental health. I think we can still improve in this regard, but I don't want another generation of journalists and workers who think they can never quit working and cannot live their lives.
Listen, Dawn.
Listen, that was a sermon in and of itself. I don't think we need to say anything.
I was going to say, first of all, that would preach.
Okay.
Number one, it would absolutely preach. Literally this morning, I was lying in bed and I've just been like so tired lately. And I know that I'm burnt out and I need to get to vacation and all this other shit. But like, I was lying in bed this morning and I was like, I set my alarm to get up earlier so I could work out. And then like, it went off and my body was like,
I know you fucking lying.
And so I laid. Listen, I laid right back down, and then I go through the anxiety wheel of, I should get up. No, but I'm tired. But I'm trying to have a new routine. Yeah, but your body feels like you need to sleep more. But, and do that whole thing, and then fall asleep, and then wake up an hour and a half later feeling guilty that I didn't get up. Literally, that was me this morning.
Listen, here's the thing. The two hours before this podcast recorded, baby, I was laying in the bed. I couldn't fall asleep, but I was just like, you know what? Let me just sit my ass down, pop a podcast in the air, and just literally do nothing. And it was glorious. So shout out to you, Don Rhodes. Make sure y'all are following Don Rhodes online. Fabulous, fabulous, fabulous work that she's doing. All right, now let's get into dishonorable mentions, a time for, you know, us to call out the stories, the people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out either for their good or their foolishness. Jared, let's go first. You go first.
I feel like this is an unusual one for me, but I want to give a shout out to the military and diplomatic teams that evacuated 122,000 people from Afghanistan over the last month. I know that is no small feat. I know that there's a lot of commentary about it, whether it was enough or whatever, and how we got out, and whether or not you think we should have been leaving Afghanistan and all that. But I do want to say to the men and women and people
good
who
job.
Are part of the military, thank you. honey, I'm learning, honey. I'm getting better, honey. Like
she's
a fine
growing,
wine,
honey.
Right?
She's growing.
We talked about liking a cab. Listen, But I know that there will be debate about it and all that kind of stuff, but moving that many people in such a short amount of time, I know that it was a lot of work. So I want to give a shout out to them. The other thing that I wanted to say is, like, if we can do that overseas across the world in Afghanistan, we should be able to do something a little bit better for Louisiana and all of these southern states when we know that storms are coming, when we know that things are going to wreck neighborhoods. But, like, if we can do this for the Afghan people and Americans that are overseas, we sure as fuck should be able to do something over here to be able to help people that so that they're not without power, without water, without, you know, cooling systems, without food for days and weeks and maybe even months. The people of Louisiana are going through the worst of it right now. And I mean, I don't know what the comparisons are between this and Katrina, because I've had to turn off my news alerts because it's too depressing right now. But, like, the people of Louisiana need your help. They need your money. They need your time. They need your prayers. And that's going to take that is going to take a long time to recover. I went to New Orleans right after Katrina to report on it. And, like, it's, those people deserve so much better. Yeah. And I'll just put it that way.
I completely agree. And you want to know who else deserves so much better? We do, okay? The human populace, the general population. And this ties into my first dishonorable mention, which again goes to the Breakfast Club for just continuing to be a trash entity that continues to prop up and use its platform to allow homophobes and transphobes to continue perpetuating and spreading their foolishness. I'm not even going to say too much more on that. The Breakfast Club can kick rocks. But in better news, my honorable mention this week goes to somebody by the name of Maya Cade, okay? She created this new website that you all should check out called blackfilmarchive.com. It is a living register of black films, and in its current iteration, it showcases, I think it has over 200 black films. Don't get me to lying about the years, but they're classic black films from back in the day that are now streaming, and she's created this website that archives all of them, has little blurbs about the film and where you can stream them. I think it's a beautiful idea for those of us who consider ourselves to be, you know, black film aficionados and stuff like that. Check out this site, blackfilmarchive.com. See what they got going on and, you know, add some new films to your streaming list, all right?
I love that. Okay, I also wanted to give a shout out. I forgot this one, but Laura put it in here for us. To Al Roker, who you might know as America's weatherman over on the Today Show. He has been the black man over there doing the weather for 150 years. I just want to shout him out because he was standing out there in the midst of the hurricane getting beat down, okay, like by the wind and the water. But he was saying, you know, to all those young folks who out there,
hey, guess what? Screw you, okay? Try to keep up. Keep up, okay?
Okay, but I also just want to be clear, at least the people that I saw critiquing him, they weren't critiquing him because he was old. They were critiquing him because they were like, why do we have somebody in the middle of a fucking storm just so that we can get live shots?
I mean, it's an ongoing debate all the time, right? Like, there's always a conversation about whether or not we should have reporters out there doing those report. Where are you on that? Because I go back and forth.
Because here's the thing. Those of us who are, like, quote-unquote seasoned, you know, who have more seasoned experience in these industries or who have been indoctrinated in, like, the traditional way of doing industry, we look at something like that and we're like, listen, that's the job. And I understand that. But we've got to get out of that, because if Al Roker and his team got swept up by Ida, we'd be having a different conversation. And let's leave it there.
But also, Al Roker did say, like, I want to be clear, I volunteered for this. Like,
of course he did.
So that's a different thing.
Because he's a journeyman. He's a journeyman journalist. That's what I was saying. Of course he volunteered.
No, yeah. I'm with you. I'm with you. Laura, let's go for another 45 minutes on this. So really what I think is the problem. No. It's time for
Black History is happening every day.
Oh, All right. I want to give a shout out to someone I was going to give an honorable mention to, but we thought we would make this the Black History is Happening every day. I'm going to give a shout out to Nia DaCosta, the director of Candyman that came out over last weekend. The story from Deadline reads this way. With the $20.4 million opening of Candyman, director Nia DaCosta becomes the first Black female director to debut a movie in the number one weekend spot at the domestic box office, which is amazing and fabulous for Nia, but also kind of ridiculous for the industry to be still having these kinds of records being made in 2021. But Nia DaCosta, congratulations on what you did for the culture and making history.
Yeah, and I just want to do a little asterisk. Sorry, this is my Black film side jumping out. And yes, she is the first Black woman to have a film debut at number one.
Are you about to play?
But me? No. But I just want to note that there's at least one other Black woman whose debut week brought in more money, but did not land at number one because of a competing film. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that's Ava DuVernay's A Wrinkle in Time. So I do just want to, you know, note those particulars. But yeah, shout out to you, Nia. Maybe I'll see your movie. Maybe I won't. I don't know, girl. I don't do that Candyman stuff. How you're doing? Okay.
Before we go, time is running out to get your ticket to see our very first Fanti Live. We'll be streaming online. It's this Sunday, September 5th, and we've got a supersized show planned for the London Podcast Festival. It doesn't matter where you are to attend.
Yes.
If using, as Travel would call it, London Town.
Don't put that on me.
It's terrible.
Do not put that on me.
That was exactly what you said, and that's why on the flyer it has London Town.
Y'all.
All right, if you are in London Town, it's at 8:30 p.m. your time. If you're on the East Coast here in the States, it's going to be at 3:30 p.m. And if you're on the West Coast like us, it's going to be at 12:30 p.m. You can see the episode notes for details, but go right now to fantipodcast.com. That's fantipodcast.com to get your tickets, because it's going to be on Sunday and it's going to be a lot of fun. We have special guests joining us. You want to talk about that?
Yes, I will say it now because it'll be on the social media pages by the time y'all listening to this. Okay, we've got three people joining us for this fabulous live show. We have Char Jocel. She's the MVP, the Fanti MVP. She will be joining us. We've got Corrice, who does our music. We shout him out every single show. He will be helping us out with a very, very special segment. Okay, and then for our Fanti conversation, where we will be talking about meme culture, honey, all right, we have the one and only Brittany Luce of For Colored Nerds fame, also the Nod fame. She will be helping us, you know, delve into why the hell all y'all are running up these crates in the hood. Okay.
Yes. But also, we're going to be able to take your questions. If you're live streaming, we'll be able to get your feedback for the live feedback that we'll be doing on the show. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yes.
It's going to be a supersized episode. We've been working on this for a little while, so excited about that. Before we go, if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, we ask that you leave us a 5-star rating and a review. Let us know what you think about the show. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us using @FantiPodcast or follow us on Instagram @FantiPodcast. Make sure to use the hashtag FantiFam.
And as always, you can send us an email at fanti@maximumfun.org. If you'd like to become a financially contributing member of the Fanti fam, you can do that at maximumfun.org/join. Our music, as always, brought to you by the one and only Corrice, Correce, wherever you get Slayworthy audio, and you can check them out at the live show on Sunday. Uh-huh. And our graphics are done by the wonderful folks over at Moonhouse Creative, led by the one and only Ashley Wen.
Our producer is Laura Swisher.
Okay.
This is a production of Maximum Fun. You better go to fantipodcast.com.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Should we start over?
No.
I'm gonna start over. It's
no,
fine.
No, you don't
it's
have fine. To start over. It's fine. It's authentic, honey.
No, it's bad. Here we go.